Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Earning your degree online doesn't mean you have to go about it alone. At Capella University, we're here to support you when you're ready. From enrollment counselors who get to know you and your goals, to academic coaches who can help you form a plan to stay on track, we care about your success and are dedicated to helping you pursue your goals. Going back to school is a big step, but having support at every step of your academic journey can make a big difference. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network.
This is James Altucher, and we're about to meet my guest for the James Altucher Show. And he's a very interesting guest, Brett McKay, who started the site The Art of Manliness. The reason I'm even doing this intro is because what I found when I opened the site and read his books and read all the content was that this is really a site that's advice for everybody, not just men, not just women. I was really fascinated by the kind of range and depth of all the advice in the site. I was also impressed by the fact that, hey, he chose himself. He started from scratch, built up to the point where I guess he's making close to a million a year in revenues and 12 million page views a month. And it's very impressive. We can all learn from a site like this, both the content of the site and how he built his business. So without further ado, here is my guest, Brett McKay, creator of The Art of Manliness. And Brett, how are you doing, first of all?
Doing fantastic, James. How about yourself?
Good. Where are you right now?
I'm in my closet in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
You know what's really funny is I'm in a closet because I live right near a train line, and the only way I can have decent sound quality, I'm in a closet filled with foam so that you can't really hear the train when it passes.
Yeah, that's why I moved to the closet too. Where I had the podcast set up before was like right next to my neighbor's house, and he had these dogs that just barked all the time, and it was getting in the podcast, so I had to move to the other side of the house into this closet. So
see, it's weird. It's like in the let's say the last generation was radio, and they have these big fancy studios, and there's a big light on, like no one could come in here because we're on the radio. Like it's like this sacred religious space. And here we are now trying to do our own thing, but we have to be in closets right now.
Yeah, well, it is what it is. It's pretty funny.
That's the way you do your own thing. I get so many emails from people saying, oh, I've got this great idea, but I have a full-time job, so now can you fund me because I have a great idea? No, it really involves sitting in your closet for years, doing your thing and building up, and that's how stuff happens.
Yeah, it's all about action.
And so, Brett, you know, a couple of things. I want to kind of go down a bunch of different avenues with you. First off, I love the site, The Art of Manliness, and I want to talk about how you've kind of built this up into a decent business for yourself and for your wife, Kate, who I know is your partner on the site. And I also want to talk about the specific advice you often give on the site, because I sort of feel like even though the title is The Art of Manliness, the site itself is really applicable, and I find the advice applicable to both men and women. Like I often share your articles with my wife, Claudia, and I say, see, this is exactly what I was talking about. And so she reads your articles. And I notice on your Facebook page on the page which tells who Facebook likes you, many women like the site. So it's not like a site just for men.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, we can definitely talk about that. I mean, the main impetus of the site is helping particularly men grow up well. And so we talk about just stuff that you're supposed to learn as you're growing up so you can turn into a well, adjusted, functioning member of society. And we take some of like just basic life skills.
Which, by the way, is really funny because what you're saying is, and this is true, women sort of know how to grow up. Like they're more mature in a weird way. Like I'll tell you, and then I've been talking a little too much in this intro, but my very first apartment that I lived in by myself, where I paid the rent and got electricity and bought myself some furniture, I was 41 years old. Every other time was with a woman and she knew how to do everything. Or yeah. I lived in hotels. When I was in my 20s and early 30s, I lived in a hotel. So not until I was 41, I lived on my own.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's just, it's something that's, I guess, unique or different between men and women. But yeah, when we talk about this stuff, we try to cater it towards male taste and like, you know, put it in a way where like guys are like, oh yeah, maybe I should do these things because it will help me be attractive to women. Because
like
women,
what?
Well, you know, just like how to, you know, basic things like when you're in college, like how to keep a clean apartment, right? We had this one post about how to make a good first impression with your apartment. So you know, you're dating a girl, you're dating a woman, you bring her to your place, and a lot of guys, like, they just, it's a pit, right? And there's like this funny like Reddit thread where women came into men's apartments and they were talking about some of the ghastly things they saw. And this one guy didn't have toilet paper in his bathroom. And she was like, do you have toilet paper? And he's like, no, I just use the bathroom at school, so I don't have to buy toilet paper. Which is actually, you know, it's
that
pretty,
really...
that's pretty, yeah, you know, it's pretty frugal. And I admire his thinking. But if you want to impress the ladies, you have to create a welcoming nest, for example.
Well, now, let me ask you this. Why don't you think it's reverse? Like, why is there this difference? Like, particularly with the apartments?
Yeah, I don't know. I think guys just, we're very focused. When we get focused on something, whatever it is, whether it's video games or business or whatever, we get sort of single tracked on that, and other stuff can just fall to the wayside, and we'll just do what we have to do to survive. So long as it gives us enough time and money to focus on what we think is important at the time.
But women get focused too. Like, it's not as if, like, I see many women get focused on their particular activities or their entrepreneurial activities or creative activities.
I don't know, just in my experience, like, my wife is like super detailed oriented. Like, she's always managing, she's always got the list going on, right? Where I lose track of that stuff, and she's always having to remind, hey, you need to, you know, send this email to this guy, or you need to reach out. Like, she does it, like, I don't know how she does it. Me, I'd rather think, I just get lost in my own little world where I'm focusing on a certain aspect, and I got my wife there helping me out and keeping me on track.
Now, I want to get into kind of like the, I think a lot of listeners, you know, in this economy are kind of going through something where they'd like to, let's say, pursue their passion or build a business on the side or build up a website business, maybe very similar to how you have. So I want to get into those details.
Sure.
But now, actually, I'm really curious, how did you meet your wife?
We met at the University of Oklahoma at church, and we dated, and then we got married, and now we have kids.
Did you know as soon as you met her, this is it, I'm going to marry this woman?
I don't
what did you like about her?
Right at the moment, she's smart. Well, I liked her because she was all about like made in America apparel, which I was too. I was kind of in a phase where I was like the anti, you know, when you go to college, you get on these kicks, and I was like in this like anti sweatshop.
Yeah, when you go to college, you have opinions.
Yeah, you got opinions, right? And so, you know, we talked about how we have a love for made in America apparel. She's funny and just smart, beautiful. And I mean, I just clicked. I mean, I clicked with her instantly.
And how long have you been married for?
We will be 9 years. Got married in 05.
And you know, she's been with you from the beginning on this website. And you know, I work with my wife on. Somebody told me the other day that almost every business is started with a partner. And if the guy comes in, or the woman, and comes into a venture capitalist and pitches the business and there's no partner, you can guarantee the spouse is the partner. So, and that's what it seems like with you. And I know with all of my activities, Claudia, my wife, is my business partner also, which is a weird relationship. So what kind of problems in your relationships have happened over the past 9 years because you guys are not just romantic partners, but also business partners?
Yeah, that's a big challenge. And it's something weird. I've noticed that there's a lot more of like the husband-wife teams, like in startups. I'm seeing that more and more.
That could be, yeah.
But the challenge is, you know, just letting personal life bleed into business life and business life bleed into personal. I mean, it's all one and the same. And sometimes it's hard to separate maybe a dispute or disagreement you had about, you know, family or personal, something went there, and bring that to the business side of things.
How do you resolve it? Like, what's like, I just could think of myself with Claudia, like when we just wrote a book together, and it was the first time we were writing something together where, you know, my voice and her voice intermingled. Yeah. And it was complicated to figure that out. Ultimately, we solved it by going on a silent retreat so we couldn't speak to each other while we each wrote our sections of the book.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually a good idea. I mean, one thing is like assigning, you know, delegating tasks and roles, right? Having clear, defined assignments and roles helps out a lot. Because then there's like no like toe stepping, right? There's like none of these like unspoken assumptions like, oh, that was my thing. Why are you doing that? So like your tactic that you did with your wife is a great example of that, right? So you guys did things separately. You had, you know, predefined tasks and roles in that book, and you did your thing. So I think that helps out a lot. And that's something you just sort of develop. I mean, yeah, it's kind of, we never really been deliberate, like sit down, okay, you know, this is what we're going to do. But when we've had those moments where it's like, okay, we need to talk here, where things are kind of getting, there's a breakdown here. That's when I sit down, we establish like, okay, this is what you're going to be in charge of. This is what I'm going to be in charge of. And then we ask each other, how can we help each other on our different delegated roles?
You know, there's this notion in relationships of splitting the difference. So
yeah.
For instance, if one person's a little cleaner than the other, then what happens in the relationship is that the slightly messier one becomes 100% messy, and the slightly cleaner one becomes 100% responsibility for the cleanliness of the house. And,
yeah.
And you mentioned earlier, Kate is more detail oriented. Do you ever find that you split the difference on this, where you give her all of the details and all of the scheduling, and you do the content or design whatever it is? Do you ever find there's a problem there?
That happens sometimes if you're not like, I guess, intentional or deliberate like that, you can slip into that easily. So yeah, it's something you gotta be aware of for sure.
Does she call you on that? Like, don't make me do all the scheduling.
No, I mean, she'll just, you know, a gentle reminder. We try to like not get angry about things and just talk to each other rationally. But, you know, that's not to say we don't argue and have those like debates and yelling fights, but, we try not to do that. And when it does happen, like, we resolve it really quickly. We just start like laughing about how ridiculous, like, what this is. I can't believe we're actually arguing about this because it's dumb. And then we just move on.
That's good.
So I think having a sense of humor is vital and essential for working with your spouse. Because if you don't, you're going to go nuts.
I think that's key. So let me give you one trick. You could try this and tell me if it works, if you've never done it. So you wake up earlier than her, and I don't know if you guys drink coffee in the morning or whatever, but dress in a tuxedo and be waiting for her with like a tray of coffee and cookies or whatever, in a tuxedo at like 5:30 in the morning.
5:30. Well, if I did that at 5:30 in the morning, my wife would throw a pillow at me because I'm like the early bird and she's the night owl. So
I see.
Yeah, if I woke up at 5:30, that would not be good. But yeah, I mean, I think there's something too in any relationship where both spouses, the husband and the wife, or whatever your arrangement is, I mean, you should seek to serve each other and try to make each other's day better. There's like this notion in relationships nowadays, like everything's got to be 50-50, like this sort of tit for tat thing. Like, if you do this, then I'll do that, and if you don't do that, well, I'm not going to do anything for you. You know, that's like a business transaction. Like, you can't treat a personal relationship like that. And you should just look for opportunities to serve your spouse.
That's a really good piece of advice. Seek to serve each other. So
yeah,
don't make it like a math equation. Just like, how today can I serve my spouse?
Yeah. Without expecting anything in return. Right.
So, okay. So let's talk about the business today and then where it started. So, sure. So the Art of Manliness, the site, you sell stuff, there's a podcast, there's all sorts of things going on. Give me an outline of the business, where you're at right now.
Sure. So the primary, I think, thing going on in the Art of Manliness is our content on our main site, artofmanliness.com, where we publish something 4 days a week, at least 4 days a week, and sometimes five. But we publish content on a variety of topics. It's basically it's a men's lifestyle site, similar to Esquire or Men's Health, with less of an emphasis on six-pack abs and sex tips that you often see in those sort of men's lifestyle publications.
You see almost none of that in your site, actually. It's an oddly respectful site in the manosphere.
Well, I mean, it's why I started the site in the first place. I was like reading, you know, I was like, when I was in law school, I was at Borders one night looking at the men's magazine. It's something I always do. I used to subscribe to Men's Health. I, you know, go to Borders and just get all the men's magazines and flip through them. And, you know, like, I just found like I was like not relating to the content anymore. I didn't relate to it, right? I was married, and a lot of the content in the men's magazines and like men's websites are like geared towards like young single guys. And, you know, a lot of it was like sex tips, right? Like, you know, how to have sex for 5 hours or whatever. And these, you know, it's just like, I enjoy sex. Sex is fantastic. It's a great part of being a man, and for a woman. But it's like, it's not the only part of life, right?
No, and also a lot of the advice on the site, honestly, is for men and women. Like, when we'll talk about some of these later, but like how to follow up after a meeting,
sure.
How to have integrity in your life, how to explain failure in a meeting, the problem with minimalism. So I feel like a lot of your best content is good for both, but I understand, you know, you needed kind of an umbrella, and I appreciate, you know, like the grooming and all these other sections of your site that do gear towards man. And it's almost like a little bit the old-fashioned man. Like, you have this quote, every generation revolts against its fathers and makes friends with its grandfathers, which unfortunately for me might make me a child molester, but that's another story. But it's kind of an old-fashioned, nice way of looking at it. But
yeah.
Okay, so give me the basic metrics. Like, how do you measure your site?
Sure. So like page views is key for us, because we're primarily make our revenue from advertising. So right
Which
now
Which is also old fashioned. Like, not that many blogs out there make their revenues primarily from advertising.
Yeah. That's something we started out with, and it worked for us. So right now we get about 12 million page views a month. So that's the big metric for us, always trying to increase page views. But then also social engagement's big for us. We've over the years been able to acquire a very active and engaged Facebook fan page. So it's like over 500,000 Facebook fans.
A lot of them, again, both men and women. I couldn't figure out who was more.
What's interesting is that there's a lot of women who read the site that sort of like their moms, they're single. There's a lot of single moms who read the site. And they use the Art of Manliness as sort of like a way to figure out how to raise their son, because they don't have that.
That's fascinating.
So that we get a lot of letters from single moms who are like, they appreciate the content that they're putting out there, because it's helping them raise their son.
Actually, it's funny. It's good for single moms, but it's also good for any parents, because again, like I said, I didn't have my own apartment until I was 41 years old. Like, I could have used this site when I was 20. And maybe I would have learned a thing or two.
Well, I mean, it's funny. Like, I've learned a lot just writing the content. You know, I'm not I don't put myself out there as like this expert in, you know, being well adjusted or being a man or whatever. A lot of this site is my opportunity to just explore these things and try to figure out and learn, and then I just share what I've learned along the way.
So 12 million page views a month.
Yeah.
Plus, you sell some stuff. You have advertising. Can you tell me like roughly the revenues per year?
High six figures.
Okay, that's great. Congratulations. That's a very good site. And how many years did it take to build up to that?
Let's see. Probably started in 2008. Took 4 years. No, longer than that. 5 years.
Yeah, and I actually think I wrote an article once, The Ultimate Guide to Reinventing Yourself, and my thing was is that it does take 4 or 5 years of life change before you really start seeing abundant fruits from it. And so you know, so that's where you are right now. But like, how did you first start building the traffic? How did you get the word out? How did you, you know, I'm assuming you were doing the writing every day, sure. Or Kate was writing. Yeah.
It was, well, so when I started the site in 2008, I was a second year law student at the University of Tulsa, and it was just something to do for fun. It was going to be a hobby. I didn't see it as a business. My plan was to become an attorney, and that had been my plan since high school.
Ultimately, many of the best businesses start off where the guys did not want it to be a business. Google being a great example.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I enjoyed law. I really did. But then I started the site and it took off. Like, I didn't think it was going to, I just thought my friends and family would read it. But somehow other people found it. And how? They started, okay, so I'm not sure. So here's how the traffic really just launched off. So in 08, this was like when Digg was the king of the internet, right? If you got your story on the top, on the homepage of Digg, like you would just get a buttload of traffic. And so what happened was I can actually remember the day I was in wills, estates, and trusts class. And when you're in law school, when I was in class, I wasn't really paying attention all that time. And I was like surfing and working on my blog. And I realized suddenly I saw that my site like crashed. And like, I was like, what the heck's going on here? And then I checked the analytics and I saw that I was getting all this traffic from Digg. I was like, oh my gosh, I got crashed by Digg. And so, I was frantically working to figure out what was going on. And what happened was the very first article that I wrote called How to Shave Like Your Grandpa, which is about safety razor shaving and using the brush and yada, yada.
I love it. I don't even use a brush for shaving and I'm constantly cutting myself.
You should try it. It's fantastic. It makes the experience all the more enjoyable. Someone submitted that to Digg and it got on the front page of Digg. And then from there, like Delicious picked it up. That was when Delicious like would send you a lot of traffic. And then Reddit picked it up.
Old school, Delicious, Digg.
Yeah, this was like old school. So that's like at that point I was on the radar and people just started submitting my content to these social media sites and just started sharing it. And that's how it happened. That's how I got the word out about the site. And
doing something equivalent now.
Yeah.
What do you suggest they would do?
Man, that's a tough one. Because those sites they're not around anymore. One thing that I think is very, it's helped a lot of people that we've worked with is guest posting on a blog that's in your niche and write something fantastic for them. And then,
I agree with that. I tell people that all the time. I think it's the best advice because I actually think the era of the individual blog site is coming to an end. Like it's all about these sites, even like your own, where you have multiple contributors and that's where how individual writers can build their individual brand and potentially direct traffic back to other sites.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot like any other form of communication. Like the same sort of thing happened with radio, and particularly radio, where there's all these different like radio stations and like movie studios, all these different movie studios. And at the very beginning, and then slowly through time, they all sort of they formed together, right? There was like you can no longer have this sort of, it was like no more like freewheeling content creation going on. And you're seeing that now on the internet. We've had guest contributors. One guy, an example, his name's Creek Stewart. He's like a survival expert. He wrote this guest post for us. It was just a lot of fun. It was like how to build a zombie apocalypse survival shotgun. And you can check that on the site. It's just a really fun, he wanted to see like how many survival accoutrements he could put on a shotgun. So there's like flashlights and knives and like a saw. I mean, it's
pretty. Did he build it himself?
Yeah, he built it himself. And the thing went viral. It blew up. And
can you buy his gun? Not that.
No. You can't buy his gun. I mean, he gives you the instructions, like, and all the things you could buy to make this gun. But it's just really fun, and it just resonated with our readers. And that was like when zombies were really big and really popular. Since he's become a regular contributor for our site, and he's gotten a book deal. He's written, and it was because he says it was because of that post. Like a publisher reached out and saw that post and like, we want you to write a book. He's written some other, books.
He should be, He should build an email list, because the survivalist email lists, those make a ton of money.
Yeah. Well, he's and it's amazing to see him, like, what he's done with his business. Before, he was just an instructor, right? People would come to him, and they would go to his classes in Indiana. But now he's got an e-commerce store. He has, like, this thing called the Apaca Box, where it's like the subscription service things where you get a box sent to you once a month. And this one, it's like full of survival stuff.
I love that.
He's also I think it's this weekend, actually, this Saturday. He has a show on the Weather Channel called Fat Guys in the Wilderness. And it's basically he takes three fat guys out into the wild and helps them survive. And the whole idea is, like, help these guys see that, well, they can survive, you know, 3 days or 4 days in just the bitter cold winter with nothing but their bare hands. Then they can do whatever they want with their life, you know, lose weight or whatever.
So let me ask you, do you take a piece of his business? Like, you basically helped kind of establish him.
No, I mean, I got great content. That's all I'm looking. I mean, that's what I want. I just want awesome content for my readers. And I mean, I love seeing people have success like that. And you know, I can't take credit for it. I mean, cause like he writes great stuff. It's awesome stuff. He knows his stuff. He does a great job presenting it. What's great about him too, he's a survival guy, but he's not, like, weird about it, right? It's very approachable. He makes it very approachable for the average person, and it's not necessarily geared towards the people who are, you know, building bunkers in the middle of nowhere. He wants everyone to, you know, be prepared for whatever may happen. And so, I mean, it's just, you know, we were able to get in front of a big sized audience. And from there, like, he did it all, man. Like, he was very savvy, and he ran with it, and he hustled.
So this is a great example where he had an area where he was an expert. He had an area of expertise. He guest blogged on your site and probably other sites, but the post on your site went viral. Maybe it did on other sites as well. He built up probably a brand for himself and a landing page for himself where he was able to collect emails, and now he's able to sell his own stuff across his email list and still contribute to all these other sites.
Yeah, and he's got a TV show. He's got books.
He's got a TV show. So he's got a business. So for all we know, he's making high six figures as well. Like, this is how he built his business.
Yeah, I mean, he doing guest posts. And, like, the thing when I tell people, and they, like, you hear this a lot in the blogosphere, right? Like, yeah, you know, you need to do guest posts. And I used to have, like, an open submission form where people could just, like, submit stuff. Because I understand how it is. Like, I remember, like, at the very beginning when I was trying to get the word out at the site, I was just ecstatic when, you know, a site that was, you know, a big site would, like, publish something that I wrote. But what I found was, like, a lot of the stuff, like, 99% of it was just crap. It was just people who were, all they wanted is they wanted that link on The Art of Manliness. They wanted, and it was just like, you know, they could tell they didn't really read the site. They didn't really get what we were going for. And they just sort of send in this sort of, like, they just kind of, you can tell they phoned it in, because there's, like, spelling errors, grammatical errors. And it was just not formatted. And it's just, like, it was, like, short. It was just like, I read it and be like, what, you know, cause, like, one thing we pride ourselves on is, like, being very thorough and in depth with our content. I mean, most of our minimum word count on posts is either 1800 to 2000 words. Cause when we write something, like, I want it to be the most thorough, in-depth thing there is. And people would send this thing, it was like 400 words long. And I'm like, you know, I don't know. I didn't get anything from this. So, like, when people guest post, I always recommend, like, you got to give your best to them. And,
you know,
like,
the challenge is on now. I'm gonna write a guest post for The Art of Manliness. Whether you take it or not, I want you to like it. Like, I'll try to write a good one.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'd appreciate that. But, like, that's what I want. When, if you, that's the advice I'd give. Like, if you want a guest post for someone, like, that's like, you know, give them your best content. And what I loved about Creek was he made it so easy for me. He wrote this thing that, like, it fit in with our audience and sort of it was fun, yet at the same time informative. He also had all the pictures, like, ready and taken and, you know, formatted. And all I had to do was just copy and paste it and put it into WordPress.
That's so key. Like, you can't rely on, and I'm not saying whether you're a good editor or a bad editor, this is more advice for people who want to guest blog. This is in general advice for people who ask things. Make it easy for the other side to say yes. Do 95% of the work for them so it becomes easy for them to say yes.
Yeah, that advice is key. And besides just like guest posting, the other way you can apply that is like when you approach someone, you're asking for something, like be specific on what you want. I get so many emails where they're like, hey, Brett, I'd love to partner with you. And that would be the email. It's like, can you shoot me an email? And we maybe set up a phone call. And I'm like, okay, what is it that you do? Right. Like, you know, and I used to, you know, cause I like to help people. And I used to be like, okay, sure, let's talk. You know, maybe it's something we could do. I can help you. You can help me. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, it was just like, it was not a good fit at all.
You know, that's very interesting that it was 9 times out of 10. I bet you actually the ratio was even higher, that it wasn't helpful at all. Because I'll tell you, I was getting so many of those that I now outsource almost all of my email. So I have someone go through it and determine if something looks interesting, that they'll go through the first filter, and I actually almost get nothing. So yeah. Even like, you know, oh, can we have you speak here or do this or do that or post here? I get almost none of it, because most things are not useful, and most people don't know how to ask. Like the art of asking, I'm going to say that's equivalent to the art of manliness. Like, people have forgotten how to do it.
Yeah, we actually wrote a post, something, you know, similar to that. You know, speaking of email, because like there was a point, because like it's just like, it's me and my wife are doing the prime, you know, and then we also have an editor in Denver, Colorado, who helps us on some administrative things. So, but it's like, it's the three of us handling a lot of the stuff. And I used to have a contact form, right? Like every website has a contact form where you can send an email and blah, blah, blah. And my email just inbox was just out of control every day. And I found that I was spending most of my time in that inbox trying to answer all these inquiries and, you know, pitches and people wanting to do this and yeah, whatever, or just complaints, right? Someone who just didn't like what I write and they want to send me an email telling me how I suck. So what I did, I was like, you know, most of these, I found that most of these emails that I was getting, there's like that nothing came from them, right? I can like count on my, you know, my 10 fingers where I got an email where it changed my life or it improved the business. And so what I decided to do was I got rid of the contact form and I put my P.O. box address on there.
That's a great idea.
And so people have to write me a letter, and it kind of works out because we want, you know, the whole old time manliness thing that we added.
Yeah, again, like, old fashioned.
The write a hand, you know, write a letter. And what I found was just that small barrier of getting people to get a piece of paper, write it out, get a stamp, mail it, go to the post, you know, the mailbox that's, you know, just outside their house. Like, if someone's like pissed off or angry or upset with something that I wrote, then, you know, by the time they go through all that, they're just like, nah, it's not worth it. But like with email, like, you know, electronic communications, like it allows people to act on their, like, just those emotions as fast as they can, right? Like if they're angry, I'm going to tell the whole world through Twitter, right, that I'm angry. Or I'm going to email this guy and tell him I think he sucks. But like, emotions are fleeting. So if you put a barrier between, for people, you know, where they have that, you know, very visceral reaction till they actually have to do it, like 9 times out of 10, they're just going to be like, okay, this is not worth it. And what's funny is that the mail I get in that P.O. box, it's all thank you letters. They're just like thank you letters, you know, telling me how the art of manliness has helped them in some way. I've never gotten like those angry emails that I used to get where people were just like, I hate you, you suck, I can't believe, you know, this is what you stand for. I mean, just like crazy stuff. I don't get that in the mailbox. Now that now that I've said that, someone will probably write an angry
email. Yeah, now they're all like,
I'm going to show like, you.
They're writing like crayon. They're breaking out their crayons and writing like these weird cryptic letters.
Doing the cutting out magazine letters and, you know, making those weird... Do people still do that? Like, you know, like how they used to do ransom letters.
Are you asking me like I'm an expert? Like I don't know the answer to that.
No, maybe I don't know. You live in New York City, right?
Yeah, I just got one. I got three today. Like all magazine letters and an I in the middle, like a nose.
That'd be. I wonder if like the internet has made that obsolete. That'd be funny if that was the case. But anyways, the magazine thing. But that's one thing that I've done to. Help manage my day-to-day.
That's smart.
Yeah. So write a letter.
I find that a lot of the articles are extremely intelligent. So, and I don't mean this like, oh, I expected it to be like idiotic, but the articles are actually, again, That's why I almost feel like it's not necessarily about manliness. A big part of the site is about you trying to understand and having a very almost contrary opinion about many different issues. Like, I loved your article on the problem with minimalism, because a lot of people are out there saying, oh, let's throw out everything and be minimalist. But you point out that it's easier for a rich person to have no belongings than for a poor person. And maybe can you explain that a little bit? It really was a fascinating look at it.
Yeah. So, you know, that's minimalism is like, it's like trendy right now. And what's funny, the people who often become minimalists and like write about minimalism, talk, you know, refer to themselves as minimalists, like they're guys who made it rich in Silicon Valley, right? They have $1 billion and they're like, oh, I'm going to be a minimalist. And that's easy, right? Because like, if you have lots of money, you don't need lots of stuff in your house because you can just buy that stuff, right? When you need it.
So, right, like a classic example is when you travel, you actually don't need any luggage because you could have someone meet you there with like a whole wardrobe that you paid for.
Yeah, it's or even something simple as your dop kit, right? Like, oh, you don't need to buy like toothpaste and shampoo. Just buy it when you get there. And yeah, maybe it is cost, you know, a normal person going to do that. But like when you are, you know, when you have a budget and like you're going to bring your own toothpaste no matter what, like you're not just going to, that might not be an option for you.
Like computers, like if you're rich, instead of having like the big clunky laptop, you'll have the MacBook Air and an iPhone, you know, slightly more expensive, but a few millimeters thinner.
Few millimeters thinner, and this whole idea of like when you don't have much money, you hold on to stuff as sort of you know, commodities to help you out. You see this a lot with like people who lived through the Great Depression. A lot of those people, they're pack rats, right? They just hold on to stuff. I'm not talking like hoarders, like crazy hoarders, but they hold on to stuff because they grew up in a time where you held on to stuff because you could use that in the future, right? You might not know what you could use it for, but because you don't have cash on hand, you needed stuff. If you need stuff you can get on your hand that you could use, you kept it. So like my grandpa is a great example of that. And I think a lot of people's grandparents were like that. Like he kept like weird stuff, but he ended up using it somehow. He found a way to use whatever he had around the house. And he never had to go to like Home Depot to pick up screws or wood because like he had that stuff in his barn. And he could just go there. If he needed that, he'd go there. Like he had his own lumber shop in his barn that he acquired over time. So yeah, when you're a minimalist, like you don't need to do that because you have cash and you can go spend whatever it is that you're on. Another thing we talked about in that minimalism post is that, you know, minimalism is all about, you know, getting stuff out of your life, right? That's like the thing. Like, but what's funny is that minimalism still oftentimes makes your life focus on stuff because you're just concerned about getting rid of, you want to get down to that, those 100 items, right? There's like that challenge, like you only can only own 100 items in your whole possession, right? So you just become obsessed with what stuff leaves and like what stuff you keep. And you see this oftentimes on some minimalism blogs where it's like, there's like this fetishization of like stuff where they take pictures, like very artsy pictures of like just the things they own. It's like, here's my MacBook and I love this MacBook and here's my notebook. I love this. This is my notebook that I, you know, and this is my favorite pen. And like, they just like, you can tell like they're really,
you're
invested.
Totally right. It's a fetish of stuff.
Yeah.
Minimalism.
Yeah.
I love it.
So, I mean, again, though,
that's not manliness or femaleness. It's actually like a real intelligent
general
discussion about a trend on the internet.
Commentary. Yeah. And oftentimes, yeah, we'll do that. We'll just, if there's something I've been thinking about, just riff on it. And that's not to say that you shouldn't like become this hoarder or pack rat and just like buy as much stuff. Like you don't want to go to the extreme side of materialism. But it's just having, you know, like for example, you know, my wife and I could afford two cars, but we only have one car. Because we like having one car and, you know, there's no need for us to have two cars since we both work from home. But like what we advocate is just like a little bit of self-awareness about, you know, what could happen if you go down this like minimalist route and just moderating it a bit. And, you know, if you see yourself getting kind of in that bonkers, you know, side of minimalism that can happen if you're not careful, then back off and be like, okay, I need to reevaluate what I'm doing here.
We always, you know, we always approach minimalism. Again, we try not to fetishize it, but our philosophy is to buy experiences rather than goods. So we would rather take a trip where we're going to have an experience rather than buy the latest computer. Although, you know, right now I am on a MacBook Air right now, but it's not like I have a big desktop computer. I just use my MacBook Air and I take it everywhere with me.
Sure.
But so we try not to kind of we sort of live far from any store, and we focus on what our next experience could be that we pay for.
Well,
that helps us out.
Yeah. The studies show that actually makes you happier when you
we are very happy
spend your money on experiences because it gives you memories, right?
Yeah,
and you can hold on to that.
And you know, I found, you know, so I have two children, 15 years old and 12 years old. I found that in terms of, you know, parenting, that if I buy them experiences rather than, let's say, you know, the latest goods or whatever that they want, that they will remember these fond memories of me rather than that I bought them a necklace or a piece of clothing or whatever. Now, of course, they need a new wardrobe every year, but you know, we plan a lot. We plan a year ahead, like different experiences we could buy for them. You know, like vacations coming up and so on. But there's another article I want to talk about, which again is not necessarily about manliness, but I sort of feel like I need your advice on it because it's a topic that's near and dear to my heart. And in fact, Nassim Taleb at some point is going to come on my podcast. But you have an article called Two is One and One is None, How Redundancies Increase Your Anti-Fragility. And Anti-Fragile is a book by Nassim Taleb. And I really think the concept, he applies it a lot to the financial world, but I really think the concept could be applied to many aspects of life. And maybe you can explain a little bit that article, and then I will tell you my dilemma that I'm facing.
Sure. So yeah, I'm Anti-Fragile. I read that book last year. Actually, I read it twice because I enjoyed it so much.
And it's
a great book. And like, I'm not in the financial, I invest my money in index funds and that's about it. So a lot of the things that he was talking about in terms of the financial industry, like didn't really apply to me, but it was interesting to know because they gave a good application of his principles that he lays out in Anti-Fragile. But yeah, you're right. Like the principles he lays out, they apply to so many other areas of life. So like for, you know, the listeners who don't know, you know, he defines things as you can be either fragile, which breaks or fall, you know, which breaks during disruption or randomness, resilient, which stays the same during randomness or disruption, or anti-fragile, which actually grows with randomness.
Give an example of something that's fragile.
Well, Taleb gives the example of like a teacup, right? Like if a table gets knocked and the teacup falls off the table and hits the table, it's going to break, right? There's that disruption.
And you can never put it back together. Like it's over.
Yeah, it's over. Something that's resilient. I guess like you can be like a person can be resilient, right? That's all kind of the idea of stoicism. Like when you face these challenges in life, you remain calm and collected inside your inner citadel, as Marcus Aurelius would say, and you're not disturbed by the changes and randomness going on outside you. Something that's anti-fragile, kind of a practical application of that, not in the finance particularly, but like your body is anti-fragile in a lot of ways. And Taleb talks about this, where your body actually needs stress to grow and to thrive and to prosper. So for example, your bones, right? Your bones need to experience the stress of gravity to maintain their strength and to get stronger. That's why when astronauts go into outer space where they experience zero G, when they come back, their bone density goes down. It's gone down. Bicyclists have the same problem too, because they're on those pedals, like they're not experiencing the force of gravity that much on their legs. So their leg bones are often weaker than people who run all the time. So yeah, that's a great example of antifragility, where there's like a stress and your body gets stronger from that.
So how can, based on your article, how would you suggest using the concept of anti-fragility to improve your life?
Well, I mean, you just look for ways that you can become anti-fragile, and you have to apply the principles that Taleb lays out in his book. So one of them is, you know, redundancies is something he talked about. And this is a principle from engineering where you build in redundancies into a bridge or a car or whatever it is, so that if one part fails, the thing can keep going, right? And that's a form of resilience, but he makes the case that in some instances, redundancies can actually make you anti-fragile, and you can exploit randomness with those redundancies. So here's an example that's very applicable to anyone, is just having extra cash in the bank, like an emergency fund, or just like a fund that you can use to, like capital, right? If you're sitting on a big pile of cash and an opportunity, like a random opportunity comes to you, you can use that redundancy of extra cash, because, like, you know, that's a having extra cash is a redundancy to exploit that opportunity.
Or by the way, the flip side, you could say, look, I already have extra cash. I don't need to waste more time and energy going down the path of exploiting this opportunity.
Yeah, well, it's called, like, what they call it, FU money. Like, I don't need to do this because I already have this cash.
Well, but it's interesting because some people are addicted to having more money. So yeah. I know of at least one billionaire who's upset at another billionaire because he's got more billions than him. So you know, you could kind of train yourself if you have like enough cash to you know, do what you want to do in life and be creative and be fulfilled and so on. You don't need to explore always that next opportunity.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's anti-fragility as well.
Yeah, I think you're right.
But here's the problem I have, and this scares me. And I even talked to my wife about this. I feel like women are anti-fragile in terms of their health, because women and this is a big difference, obviously, between men and women. Women menstruate, for instance, so that every month that it's like they they have their period. And I find in general that women could deal with going to the doctor more. They go to a lot more doctors. And I've never been to a doctor. I've never been to the hospital. I haven't been sick in like 5 years. I rarely get sick at all. I'm really worried that once I really get sick, I'm just going to die. because I have not built up my anti-fragility. And I feel most people have. Like, I see Claudia, she's definitely anti-fragile. So, like, she takes care of herself very well, but she goes to lots of doctors and you know, does yoga every day. And really, but she also gets sick and deals with it and rolls with it. Me, as soon as I get, like, a cough, I think I'm about to die. So I feel like psychologically and physically, once I get, like, a real sickness, anybody else would just say, oh, I'll just go to the doctor and take some pills. Me, I'm going to either panic or die.
Well, I mean, if you haven't had to go to the doctor or the hospital, like, you should take that as a good sign. Like, you don't need
I know, to go, I should be grateful for it, but I'm scared. When I read anti-fragile, I got scared.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, it could be, because he talks about how if you, there's like that via negativa principle, right? Like, where if you go to the doctor, sometimes doctors do things that I think will help you, but actually hurt you, right? Because they don't know, like, because they feel like they have to do something, right?
Oh yeah, doctors are evil. I wrote about this actually as a guest post on crack.com, but, and the guy, the editor of crack.com, didn't even want to publish it because his wife was a doctor, but like, people die by going to the doctor. Like, doctor mistakes account for 100,000 deaths a year in the U.S. And that was just one point I was making among many.
Yeah.
It's also the profession with the highest suicide rate. It's 26% of doctors report some form of alcohol abuse. Like, doctors are scary.
Yeah. So, but I don't know. I think you're fine. I mean, as long as you don't have to go to the doctor. I mean, I think you just need to work on your stoicism a bit, you know, getting your inner, build up that inner citadel and just not worry about it. But there's kind of a point between like men and women, the difference between men and women and sort of their anti-fragility. We do know that, for example, it'd be like men, women are actually more robust. Even since like the embryonic stage, there's usually more, there's like, how's it, what's it worked out? Like men or boy fetuses often abort naturally on or sporadically on a more common occurrence than say female zygotes or whatever. Their pain response between boys and women or boys and girls is different at a younger age, even as children. We do know that testosterone actually weakens your immunity system. So
now you tell me.
So, you know, but this is kind of interesting.
I should have been born a woman.
No, there's definitely a lot of advantage to being born a man. This is kind of interesting too. I've been doing a lot of research on testosterone, and they found that in hunter-gatherer societies, the men have lower testosterone levels than, say, a man living in an urban area. And the thinking goes, the reason that is because in a hunter-gatherer society, it's more important to have a robust immunity system than having super high jacked up testosterone levels. I mean, they still have plenty of testosterone to make them man and make them strong and give them those defining characteristics of masculinity. But it's lower than, say, if you compare it to some guy living in New York City, because those hunter-gatherer societies, they need a stronger immunity system, so they have a lower testosterone level.
Well, it's interesting too. In hunter-gatherer societies, there's some evidence that people have larger brains, because now in our society, everybody is honed in on their specific tasks in life. Whereas in hunter-gatherer societies, people had many tasks. Like, you had to be completely aware of all the food, potential predators, everything in like a 2 or 3 square mile radius. And you kind of had to know and keep in your head a lot more information. Now we just like, oh, I'm going to Google like herpes and figure out what's going on. And, you know, you didn't have to, you had to be smarter back then.
Yeah, you had to be a generalist for sure.
So another, and again, I love these articles because, and this is why I highly recommend your site, because it's not, like, I feel this is for men, this is for women, this is for anybody, but I love the design, I love that old-fashioned, like, Art of Manliness style to it. But another article and really series of articles you talk about, which I think is so important, and this is where your blog really intersects with my blog, you talk about the importance of integrity and how personal integrity is so linked to societal integrity, and it's really linked to happiness. And maybe, you know, talk about that a little bit. And the reason I'm kind of going through this is because I sort of feel like your blog is almost like the art of advice rather than the art of manliness. Now, and again, I know there's a lot of stuff on your site related to just manliness, but there's so much just good advice here that I think people should go for. It's a great site. But yeah, talk about integrity and what your views on that are and where you got them.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's something we've talked about a lot on the site. And the reason that is, and we've related to manliness, and here's the manliness connection, is that when I'm a classics and letters major. So I studied like ancient philosophy and Latin.
What's a letters major mean?
So yeah, letters is actually the oldest degree, I think, in the Western world. Like, that was like the degree you could get. And I think at the University of Oklahoma, they offer a letters degree. So basically it's a humanities degree, at its core. So I had to study Latin. I had to study, ancient philosophy and literature. And what else? History, and then like some other stuff. So it became like a well-rounded. Basically, it's the degree you take. The only thing you do with it is go to law school, or start a blog called The Art of Manliness. But what I found was that they were using manliness or manly in like a different way than I was accustomed to as a 20th century man. And for them, for the ancients, ancient Greeks, ancient Romans, and even up until the late 19th century. Manliness meant being a man. Like, you had to be strong and courageous, right? That was like, you had to be masculine. But manliness meant being a person or a man of virtue, right? So it meant developing temperance. It meant developing resolution. It meant developing courage, both, not just physical and martial courage, but also moral and intellectual courage, and be able to stand up for your beliefs or a cause. And a man who developed these virtues was given the title of man. Like, you're not just born a man in ancient Rome or ancient Greece. You had to become one, and that was through virtuous living. That was kind of like been a big theme on like kind of resurrecting this idea of, ancient manliness, right? This classical idea of manliness. So yeah, we talk about, living virtuous and in the sense of like the, Aristotelian virtue, right? You throw on the word virtue and people get all like, they grimace and like, oh, it's like church lady stuff. But no, it's like, we're trying to bring back this idea of just being a good, like living the good life and developing this well-rounded person in yourself and doing it in a, masculine way.
It starts off in a very small way. It's like you basically counsel don't steal the paper clips in the office, because from there it just gets bigger and bigger.
Well, yeah, that was an article we wrote last year, and we shared it from the archives recently about just how we justify mistakes or moral peccadillos that we commit. Because once you go down that path, it's easier to do it. To go make even bigger misjudgments or miscalculations or just bigger moral mistakes. Not mistakes, like wrongdoings, like doing wrong things. That's another kind of funny thing about, the difference between like today, people today compared to people in the past is like, whenever we make, these sort of gross moral errors, right? We mess up, like we always kind of couch it in sort of terms where it doesn't seem that bad. Like, oh, well, I misjudged. I had a miscalculation, right? Like, no, you did something wrong, right? Like, is that general that committed a Petraeus? Right. Is that who it was?
Yeah.
And basically had this affair and he kind of compromised, possibly compromised, state secrets, which isn't good. And he gets up and, it's like, well, I had a miscalculation. It was just, of my judgment. And I was like, no, you should have, if you were like an ancient Roman guy, you'd say, I was wrong. And it's shameful what I did. And, I'm sorry. But now it's like, we made, misjudgments and miscalculations with our moral choices. Just kind of interesting.
Right. It's funny, the language, like, oh, I made a misjudgment. It's funny because this is also related to yoga. Like, people don't realize that physical yoga, which is what every yoga studio teaches, is just one-eighth of what yoga is. And a big part of what yoga is this idea that you call manliness, they call, and it's a Sanskrit term, they call the niyamas, which is basically, keeping yourself clean, being extremely honest to the point of like, don't steal the paper clips at the office. Like, this is real yoga, and it starts with that. It doesn't start with the physical poses. So I found that it was interesting, that intersection. But integrity, flirtation, like you see this in marriages, like, people say, oh, I was just flirting. It wasn't a big deal. But flirtation could lead to the next thing. And so you always have to you always have to be strict with yourself to some extent.
You have to be on guard. We wrote about, having, affair proofing your marriage a long time ago.
How do you affair proof your marriage?
Well, you're talking about this. One advice we gave was, be careful with opposite sex relationships if you're heterosexual, right? Because you have a lot of people like, oh, yeah, I can have, my opposite sex best friend, which, I don't doubt the sincerity. Like they might be like the best friends. It's platonic. But you never know what could happen, what could shift that platonic relationship into something more romantic or intimate or sexual. Cause I can count, I know several people who have, they had, an opposite sex friend and the spouse was okay with it. Like, that's fine. Yeah. They're great. And they ended up having an affair with that person. And this is both like men and women, right? It's not just like guys are doing this. Like, it's men and women who are doing this. Because you never, there's always that, you never know, things could get rocky with your marriage, right? There's you have that, an argument or there's some kind of, low period in your marriage and you turn to your best friend who happens to be a woman and, you go and you cry on her shoulder. And then, before you know it, you didn't know what happened. Like, your clothes are off and you're rolling around in bed. And people really underestimate their emotions. And so those animalistic drives that are within us. And that's my wife and I, we're pretty strict about having, if I'm gonna have an opposite sex friend, I'm gonna have I'll bring my wife along, sometimes, right? If that's appropriate. So that's one thing. Some people will be like, oh, you'll gas, that's silly and barbaric and just old fashioned, but I'd rather be safe than sorry.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that's very important. I think that's a good way to be, because ultimately your wife's your partner in so many ways, and she's going to be the one taking care of you when you're sick and older. So it's good establish this trust now.
She'll be wiping your butt when you can't get up.
Yeah, exactly. So all that flirtation from way back, you don't want to ruin that wiping the butt part. and again, I find your site to be just like this constant list of advice. So like you talk about you know, how to make an impression or know how to follow up after meeting someone in person. So just real quickly, what's your tips on following up with someone after meeting them?
Well, actually, I didn't write that article. It was John, a contributing writer named John Coricon, who wrote that. And he's like
was the one who used to work in the Clinton White House. Then he worked for the governor of California.
Yeah. I mean, he's like the networker extraordinaire. Like this guy, I'm impressed with how well he's always networking. Right. And he's really good. And it's not like he does it in a way where it's not like you don't feel icky about it. Because like there's some people who like, you know, they go to these conferences about entrepreneurship. And, like, you know, they hear this speech. You need to network and like you need to do this. And like they start doing it. And it just like it's they do it very poorly. And you're just so like, it's
what have you learned from him about networking? Like what surprised you?
Well, I think that the biggest thing is just be useful to the person you're reaching out to. Right. Like he never like, he always comes to me with something that's useful for me. He's like, hey, Brett, I got this idea or here's this person or here's this post or I want to help you.
Like what? What's the specific?
Well, like, I mean, he's like, well, the way I met him, he had an article for me. Right. Where he's like, I have this article I want to write for you. And it's awesome. Here, it's all set for you. It's got all the images. And yeah. And it was like, it was awesome. Like it was all set. And so that's been a great thing. Like he's made introductions to great people for me that I otherwise probably wouldn't meet. So I think Manish Sethi, John Coricon introduced me to Manish, who's doing
Manish is great. I know Manish very well.
He's doing the Pavlok thing. Right.
Where, yeah. You put it around it like shocks you if you don't go along with the habit.
Yeah, it's really cool. And I got to shock him once. It was pretty fun. But yeah, I mean that was an introduction. Like I probably wouldn't have gotten if it weren't for John. And Manish is gonna reach out. And we're gonna do a podcast together, and he's gonna write a guest post for me about habits and. I'm stoked about that. So
that's cool. He's a great guy. And have you met Ramit, his brother?
I haven't met Ramit yet, but I've read his stuff and he's a funny guy as well.
He's going to be on the podcast in a few weeks. He's a very good guy.
Well, both of them do a really great job of like using psychology to improve your life in all sorts of ways. So
yeah, that's really their BJ Fogg Stanford background. So far you have the site, you sell stuff from the store. You have a couple of books out there. You've been building this business. Is this what you're going to continue doing?
Yeah. I mean, this is the what we're going to do for as long as we can do it. And because I enjoy it. And like people always like, are you going to run out of ideas and stuff? Like the problem is like I don't have enough time to cover all the topics that I want to hit. So, I mean, I have material. I have like this big giant Evernote file of all these topics I want to hit. Soon or just in the future.
Do you write every day?
I write every day. I try to write every day. Cause I feel like if you don't like you and you have that long break, you're really rusty when you get back to it. I don't have to be like massive. Like I don't have to write an entire blog post, but I try to write something.
I agree with that. I feel like if I miss 2 days, I can literally sense I can't put words I can't connect the words in the same way anymore.
Yeah.
And I have to get back into it.
Wasn't there like some quote by some like master piano player where it was like, you know, if you miss 1 day of practice, you know, you'll notice. You miss 2, your partner will notice. If you miss 3, your audience will notice or something like that. So I think it's the same sort of thing with writing as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, at this point though, you could probably consider selling the business to a BuzzFeed or whoever, like some kind of content company. Have you considered, have you had offers? Have you considered selling the business?
Yeah, we've had offers. But I don't want to sell it because here's the thing. I feel like I've spent all this time and money and sweat and blood and building up this brand, right? Or if you want, whatever you want to call it, this thing. I hate how everyone just throws around brand nowadays. It's one of my pet peeves, but I did it just now. Sorry about that. But this thing, right, where people like feel like they're invested in it. I mean, I get, you know, thank you letters where people are saying like your website changed my life or like, you know, I was in a bad place and then I stumbled upon your blog on some stupid article about pooping like a samurai. But then I started digging deeper and you had like all this great content that really helped me. And my biggest fear of like selling it to a large media entity is that they're primary concern is the bottom line, right? Is revenue. So I'm afraid if I sold it, like what they would do, like, you know, to the site and to the content, to the messaging. So, you know,
I feel like that's not a great answer because obviously if someone offered enough money, you would take it. What could they possibly do to the site that would mess it up?
Well, they would start just publishing content that, you know, sort of like the BuzzFeed stuff, right? That's what I'm afraid of. Like they would turn into sort of like the men's magazine that I didn't want to have, right? Like they start posting up pictures of beautiful half naked women and like we need to do sex tapes sex tips because those are page views generators. So that's my fear. It's like if I sold the site, they would start wanting to put that sort of content on there.
And all right, so good. So you're gonna build this up. Final thing, let's say I'm a woman and I wanna find out how men think. How can I use your site for that?
Like reading the comments helps for sure. And then like read our content about masculinity itself, right? Manliness itself. We have a few, we did a whole series.
What do you think is the most important thing a woman should know about a man that a woman probably doesn't know?
That a woman probably doesn't know?
Yeah.
A woman probably doesn't know. I would say, don't women know about men? Well, I mean, here's like one thing, and they have research to back this up, is that men are very sensitive or attuned to status. Like we all know that, like men are hierarchical. Right. But men actually respond more adversely to status defeat or status slights than women do. You know, there's parts of our brain that fire up. We release more adrenaline and cortisol whenever we experience some sort of status defeat. So that's when we look bad in front of others. That whole saying that, you know, men want respect and women want love. There's some truth to that. There's like some scientific truth to back that up. So like understand that status and how a man feels that other people are perceiving them as, that's important. And you can laugh at it, like, oh, you know, it's this, you know, sensitive male ego, but you know, that's the thing. That's how we're hardwired. So just keep that in consideration whenever, I don't know, when you're interacting with your men folk.
And what should men know about women that we might not realize about women?
I have no idea. Because I guess I haven't really explored women. That's like one thing we don't really talk about, like, I don't know.
The art of womanliness.
I don't know. Like, I guess every woman's different, but like I found in my my marriage, like my wife says, like, I want you to lead me. Like, I want you to make decisions. Like,
I feel like that's what your blog is about, though, when you talk about this stuff. Like, I sort of think your blog implicitly is saying women would appreciate more if men were to act a little bit more, I don't want to say old-fashioned, but like,
be assertive.
Traditional. So yeah. Like you say, you know, hold open the door or stand on the street side when walking with a woman. So what do you think is the basis for that? Why do you think women would want that?
Well, I think it's just sort of, I mean, you can say it's evolutionary, right? There's like, you know, that's what everyone, like the pickup artist community talks about. Like we're hardwired for this thing. But yeah, I think there's something to it. Like men are seen as, you know, women look to men as sort of protectors and providers and whatnot, and you know, very masculine attributes is, you know, a man who's assertive and confident, and women find that attractive. Like if you ask women like what they find attractive, they don't say like, oh, you know, just a guy just doesn't really have any self-confidence or he hates himself, and you know, yeah. They want like a confident man who can stand up for himself and have the confidence to take risks that can propel his career forward or help their family out. And yeah, I mean, I think a lot of, and I think the part of the problem is that a lot of men, particularly who were born after the 1950s or whatever, were sort of indoctrinated in this thing where it's like, you know, men and women are equal, right? Like, okay, I'm not going to disagree with that. Like men, if a woman does the same type of work that a man does and whatever, like they should be paid the same, right? When women should have the right to vote, yada, yada. But, taken too far, I think a lot of men use that as an excuse to sort of cop out and be like, oh, well, you know, I'll let my wife, you know, I don't want to like be the, you know, authoritative patriarch. So I'm not going to make any decision. I'll just let my wife make the decision. I'll let my girlfriend make the decision. But like telling you guys, like women don't want to make the decision all the time. So like when you're going on a date, you know, have a plan. Like, hey, I'd like to ask you, I'd like to take you on a date. Let's go get dinner here. I'll pick you up at 7. How's that sound?
You know, I think that's really true. Like, and I'll give a great example. And this is just from when I was like 18 or 19. So it's an immature example. But I was going out with my very first girlfriend. And we went to the video rental stores. It was old fashioned. And we were going to pick out a video cassette tape for our VCR to watch a movie. And I couldn't decide what movie I wanted to see. And she really wanted me to make the decision until finally she picked up a bunch of videotapes and just threw them at me and like walked out the store.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you gotta be decisive and take the lead. And so whenever you like have that conversation with your girlfriend or your wife where it's like, you know, where do you want to go to eat? We'll never respond with, I don't know, where do you want to go? Like, have an answer, right? Like, say something like, I want to go to get barbecue, you know, and she doesn't want that. She can suggest something else, right? Like she's an adult. But you know, have the plan, make a decision.
You know, it's funny because, so Claudia, my wife, she's from Argentina and tango is big in Argentina and she took dance lessons and we've taken tango lessons together. And the key thing is you could make the woman a successful dancer if the man is just really good at leading.
Yeah.
And that's the key to tango, really.
Yeah. Like ballroom dancing is it's a good like metaphor for relationships between the sexes. People always go to that. Yeah. If you want the woman to look good, the man has to take the lead and you come up with this thing that looks fantastic and it feels fantastic. But today I feel like a lot of people, like they're just so confused about like, you know, gender roles and like, you know, okay, I'm the man, I don't want to step on your toes, or, you know, woman wants to, you know, I'm an independent woman. And so like, then when they get together for this, you know, metaphorical ballroom dance, like there's a lot of toe stepping and like people going the wrong way and it just feels awkward. And it's just an unpleasant experience and you want to get off the dance floor as soon as possible to end, you know, cause it's just a horrible experience. But like when people have some sort of, yeah, like I said, kind of roles and where the man leads and the woman vault, like it's a beautiful thing.
So Brett, this has been great. You've kind of given advice all across the board. Let me ask your advice on one thing here. So
sure.
if I call this podcast Brett McKay and the Art of Manliness, I'm afraid only half my audience will click on it. What do you think I should title this podcast?
You know what? I think people will still click on it because here's the thing. I don't know, like women, for some reason, like they like guy stuff. It's kind of weird. We've always talked about this. Like when I know a lot of women who read Esquire, they'll read GQ because they like the content there. But like guys won't like, most guys aren't going to sit down and read Family Circle or Southern Living or whatever.
It's funny. My wife subscribes to Esquire, but I don't subscribe to any magazine.
Yeah. But yeah, it's really like women, I don't know, for some reason are drawn to guy stuff, but guys not so much to lady stuff. It's just one of those interesting things. So I don't know. Like, I think you could get away with calling it the Brett McKay and the Art of Manliness because your women readers would be like, okay, what is the Art of Manliness? And I'm intrigued by this. And what does that mean?
All right. You know what? I am going to title it that and I will report back to you because I think this is a great podcast. You've given lots of great advice and all about entrepreneurship, other types of advice. And I will report back to you on how it did compared to other podcasts that I've had.
You should do like an A/B test. I don't know if that's possible, but that'd be pretty funny.
That would be funny. I don't think I can do that though.
Nuts.
Yeah. Or maybe for Stitcher, we'll do like Android, I'll title it one thing, and for iTunes, I'll title it something else.
You could try that and then let me know.
All right. Well, Brett, thanks a lot. This is really great. I'm actually going to see if I can be up for the challenge of submitting an article to your site. I'll try to do a good job and I'll make it easy for you to say yes. And thanks once again. Let me ask you one more final question.
Sure.
What other podcasts or books should I be listening to and reading?
Podcasts and books. You know what? I'm not a big podcast guy. When I do listen to podcasts, I listen to Freakonomics.
Stephen Dubner, good friend of mine, and he's been on my podcast.
Just so many great insights from that one. And then I listen to Marketplace Money because I just enjoy sort of the personal finance stories. And then books. I'm actually right now reading two interesting, really great books. One is called it's the biography of John Boyd, And he was a fighter pilot who revolutionized the art of war. He served in World War II, Korean War, and Vietnam. And this guy basically just revolutionized war fighting. But the principles that he established and the strategies that he established are applicable not just to war, but also to business and any other arena where there's sort of a competition. So really, he's a really interesting character. Highly recommend you pick up that book and listen. And then read it. And I'm also reading John Wayne biography. The latest one. And I got to say, I grew up watching John Wayne movies. My parents are big John Wayne fans. So I enjoy John Wayne movies. But this is the first time I actually learned about John Wayne or Duke Morrison. That's his his full name. His real name is Marion Morrison, but everyone called him Duke. He was a cool guy. He is a really interesting, interesting guy. And you get some insights on business from John Wayne as well, because he had his own production company. And he had to sort of navigate the studio system that existed in the film industry back in the day.
Sort of how Charlie Chaplin did it a few decades earlier.
Yeah. I mean, and John Wayne, he was very conscious of, his image, right? He understood that people looked to him as this paragon of masculinity. And it was a weight, a burden that he bore. He sometimes felt uncomfortable, but he tried to live up, even in his personal life, to that image that was projected on the screen. And it's just interesting to learn. What I found fascinating is just learning how the film industry was back in the 20s and 30s and 40s, because it's completely different than what it is today. I've just been fascinating to read. It's a long one. I mean, I'm still not finished with it, because it keeps going and going, but it's all really, really fascinating and really good.
And because I love comedy, what comedians are your favorite comedians?
Comedians are my favorite comedians, man. I mean,
I'm putting you on the spot.
You're putting me on the spot, because this is stuff I don't think about. I mean, I like Louis C.K. I like Jerry Seinfeld. I've been to a few of his shows.
Really?
Yeah.
You've actually gone to the shows.
I haven't gone to
any of his shows.
When he's come to Tulsa, I've gone to the shows, and they were really funny. Chris Rock is always funny. But yeah, I mean, I love watching Louis C.K. because what I love about Louis C.K. is he gives these really insightful remarks and comments about just sort of everyday life, where you're like, yeah, man, that's not good what we do as a society. We are a bunch of whiners. We need to suck it up and not be so entitled. Yeah. He does a great job at that.
That's great. Well, Brett McKay, The Art of Manliness. I highly recommend people check out your site every week. I actually also recommend guys in particular should buy your books, but actually everybody should buy your books. One of them is The Art of Manliness. The other one is The 31 Days to, what was the title? The 31
Days. Yeah, it's called Heading Out on Your Own, 31 Basic Life Skills in 31 Days. So this is for, if you're 41 years old and you haven't lived on an apartment by yourself, this is the book for you.
I read it and I was like, oh my God, I'm a failure as a human being, because I should have been doing this at the age of 18 instead of 41.
Yeah.
So, and on that note, thanks very much, Brett. Thanks for appearing on the show.
Thank you, James. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
For more from James, check out the James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network at stansberryradio.com and get yourself on the free insiders list today.
Imagine earning a degree that prepares you with real skills for the real world. Capella University's programs teach skills relevant to your career, so you can apply what you learn right away. Learn how Capella can make a difference in your life at capella.edu.